Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
Guerrilla Radio, recorded October 8th and 9th, 2024. Well, October marks the olive harvest throughout the Mediterranean. That essential tree is revered there, not only for its place at the center of the Mediterranean diet, but also symbolically as the herald of peace and prosperity nearly everywhere else. One must, you see, have faith in the future to nurture and bring a slow-growing olive orchard to fruition. But today is 2 October 7th, and there's little optimism for replacing the orchards torched in Gaza and West Bank, or in dousing the fires defining our times. The other major war still fought but largely forgotten in the Western presses grinds on in Ukraine, though there is some hope the talks begun in Istanbul in 2022 may yet resume, promising perhaps a peace of a sort to come before Christmas. John Helmer is a journalist and author who's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He serves as principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, has been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and advised governments politically at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and his lately released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. His recent article at Dances with Bears, Sending a Boy to Do a Man's Job, Vladimir Medinsky to Negotiate Istanbul 2, examines the failures of Istanbul in the first instance and prospects for a peace agreement in a renewed process. John Helmer in the first half. And 2.5 years on, the trauma created by the Canadian government response to the COVID-19 outbreak is yet to be adequately addressed. The shock suffered the system due to that reaction, it can be argued, was more devastating than the pandemic itself, and few in the government responsible seem anxious to either acknowledge mistakes made or provide remedies for the dangerous legal precedents it created. Ray McGinnis is an author and retired educator who, concerned about the unprecedented invocation of the Emergencies Act in 2022, attended and began reporting on the Public Order Emergency Commission hearings and was one of the only journalists in Canada to follow the subsequent Coutts 4 case, publishing numerous articles on its traducing of Canadian legal norms. Ray's book titles include Writing the Sacred, A Psalm-Inspired Path to Appreciating and Writing Sacred Poetry, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored, and the newly released Unjustified, The Freedom Convoy, The Emergencies Act, and The Inquiry That Got It Wrong. Ray McGinnis on writing the Trudeau COVID response and restoring Canadian justice in the second half. But first, John Helmer and planting again the seeds for peace in Ukraine. Well, welcome back to the program, John.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, it's always my pleasure. You know that, John. John, now, if not on the mighty, your name has been on the lips of the commentariat of late, with no less a worthy than Dr. Gilbert Doctorow invoking your assessment of Vladimir Putin's conducting of the special military operation in Ukraine. Doctorow says he seems to agree with you in a couple areas, namely that Putin has been weak in responding to crossed red lines in the past, and that his chief negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, is a mediocrity. But he seems skeptical of your questioning of Putin's patrons and their effects on the Kremlin policy. Do you want to discuss this back and forth you've been having with Doctorow?
Well, less important than who's doing the arguing, Gilbert Doctorow or me or others who have also joined the same argument, is the argument. What's the argument here? And the argument here is the question of what's the end of the war outcome in the Ukraine and in Europe going to look like with Europe and the United States and their allies in Asia, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, at war with Russia, at war on the ground in the Ukraine. And Russia and its allies, China, India, North Korea, and some others, holding their side of this obviously global conflict. The fundamental issues here, whether the guarantors of a peace, as set out in the first Istanbul Agreement, initialed by the minor Russian official you mentioned, Vladimir Medinsky, on Putin's direct instruction, whether those guarantor terms are at all practical today and tomorrow, and when the Russian military reaches its objectives. Let me just try to run through this, and then we can come back to what Gilbert Doctorow has to say. I put in that article that you referred to, Chris, a link so that our readers and listeners to this show can read the text of the Istanbul One Agreement. That's the agreement reached and initialed between a delegation, a Russian delegation led by Medinsky, and a Ukrainian delegation meeting in Istanbul in the last days of March 2022. These are the terms, and you can read the terms as they were printed by the New York Times some time ago. It's not true, as Doctorow suggests, that it runs for hundreds of pages. It runs for 35 pages. And you can see corrections, you can see in the text the points of difference between the Ukrainian and Russian positions. So essentially it's a draft treaty, a draft terms of agreement to end that conflict, which had started the previous month with a special military operation. Now, the fundamentals that you can see when you look at that agreement continue today, and therefore they continue as President Putin tries through secret mediation, particularly through the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, aimed at presidential candidate Donald Trump. The terms, the political terms and the military terms are all set out. Now, the fundamental points of difference that are being argued about in Moscow now between the presidency, the Kremlin on the one hand, and the general staff, the defense ministry, the military intelligence agency on the other are these. In the first place, Istanbul One set out several guarantors of the terms of ending the conflict. They were the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and China. And Russia. The argument over that subsequently is whether anything the United States, the United Kingdom, and France sign, say, or commit themselves to doing is worth the paper or the air they assert. And the reason for doubting the credibility of the United States, the UK, and France to guarantee anything is the dismal history of the Minsk agreements, Minsk protocols designed to reduce the conflict and stop the conflict, the civil war conflict in the Ukraine, which the French President Hollande and the German Chancellor Merkel have admitted were intended to be violated by them as they prepared the Ukraine for a longer war. But the guarantor value of such treaties has a very dismal history. For example, all Greeks and Cypriots know that the British guarantees for the independence and protection of Cyprus and its independence are worthless and proved to be worthless when Turkey invaded in 1974. So that there is a fundamental issue. Can you have a guarantor, a political guarantor, a political undertaking to any end of war terms that secures Russia's interest as well as the Ukraine's interest without a comparably certain military outcome? This is fundamental. President Putin is saying, yes, and he's saying repeatedly, yes, we can have a political settlement. And he refers to the terms of Istanbul One. The general staff, the military, and many of the critics in Moscow, to which my piece refers, say you can't have a political settlement with adversaries like the United States dedicated to the destruction of Russia without military security coming first. That's the first fundamental here that's that we're trying to debate today, that Dr. Owen and I are debating in print, and which are being debated under the surface. It's not in print in Moscow. The second issue comes, as I've just said it, from the terms of the treaty. Can the political elements of the treaty, for example, demilitarization, creating what is called in the treaty, the Istanbul I Treaty, permanent neutrality of the Ukraine, can that be assured and achieved by political means, by paper, by undertakings, by promises, by treaties? Is the promise of the United States to keep Ukraine permanently neutral worth anything more than the promise of the United States to Mikhail Gorbachev for NATO not to move an inch further? Well, the answer that the General Staff, the Defense Ministry, and the critics in Moscow say is you cannot have political achievement of military security of Russia without military achievement of security. And that dictates a very different outcome in the Ukraine. That's the second fundamental about which there is now debate, as there should be debate, for end-of-war terms in Moscow. The third issue that comes up when you read Istanbul I is where are the borders of the Ukraine to be drawn, and what's the range of weapons that the Ukraine in a state of permanent neutrality after the settlement, what's the range of the weapons they would be allowed to have for their self-defense? Well, the answer in the treaty, this is the draft treaty, Istanbul I, between March 17 and March 30, 2022, the borders of that treaty for the Ukraine are Crimea, Lugansk and Donetsk region. Now, as we now know, Russia now incorporates in its territory Crimea, Lugansk, Donetsk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson province. Those are not returnable. They're not negotiable. The extent of the Ukraine in its borders is smaller now. And the second fundamental issue relating to borders is what's the range of weapons that can be held by the Ukraine for self-defense. In that treaty, the range is 120 kilometers. We now know that the Ukraine has much longer range attack weapons to attack Russia than 120. They may extend to 800 kilometers. So the issue of demilitarization within borders safe for Russia's security have utterly changed. And so those three fundamentals come back to the summary point I began with. Can a political settlement be assured without a military victory on the Russian part? Can a political settlement guaranteed by the United States amount to anything in the Ukraine without Russia achieving military capitulation of the Ukraine? That's what the argument is between Dr. O and myself, but it's not really an argument. It's reflecting the fact that there is an argument, a civilized, proper, politically necessary argument between the Russian General Staff, the Russian military, and the Russian presidency over how the war should end.
I thought it was interesting when he was talking about the differing ways that you and he regard Putin and his methods and his motives. And he said that he didn't believe, and he said this with a kind of a cheeky wink, that these, quote, baddies, the oligarchs, played the kind of role in Putin's decision-making that your thinking implies. I mean, firstly, do you imply that the oligarchs are affecting Putin's policy and his thinking on the war and dealing with Ukraine, and especially with not only Istanbul I, but if there is to be a, quote, Istanbul II? Would you agree with his assessment that the oligarchs aren't playing such a role?
Absolutely not. And I'm afraid on that point, there's a fundamental disagreement. And Dr. Doctorow comes to this very late in the piece. Ever since I've been in Moscow reporting since 1989, I've been reporting on the activities of the oligarchs across all of Russia's industries, from oil and gas to shipping to diamonds to pig farming, there isn't a, to insurance, there isn't a sector of Russian industry and business that I haven't analyzed over this very long period of time. I'm not pulling seniority here. I'm simply saying that the record that readers can look at of Dances with Bears going back now more than 20 years shows that in every decision Vladimir Putin has made since he came to the prime ministry of Russia and then the presidency, so we're now looking at more than 25 years, in every one of those decisions, there is a significant oligarch input, and that continues today in the domestic economy, and it must and does influence the conduct of the war. For no lesser reason than we know that every significant oligarch has tried secretly to make his own peace with the United States in order to save himself from the personal sanctions which the U.S., the European Union, and other states have inflicted. And that starts with Roman Abramovich, the sponsor on the Russian side, the prompter of Mr. Medinsky, and the, let's call it, co-author of the Istanbul negotiations. Abramovich tried to save himself and his wealth and assets in the United States and elsewhere by promoting a concept of peace, and he's continued to do that. But he's not the only one. They've all tried. They've all failed. To suggest that the oligarch group, including those well-known officials in the Russian government, the governor of the central bank, Nabi Ulina, and the other members of the Russian financial policy, fiscal policy advisory group that have long advised Putin, that group has a very powerful influence on the president's decision-making. And in any polity of any kind, you'd expect that. To suggest that's not true now is absurd, it's wrong, and there is no evidence to substantiate it. But if anybody has any doubt, I've even not only published regularly Dances with Bears on a website, but you can read the Sovcom Plot book, which rather well shows by case study method how Putin dealt with the fate of the Russian shipping industry. And that evidence comes not from individual or secret or anonymous sources, but from the written records and testimony of nearly 15 years of litigation in the British High Court.
Do you agree with, first of all, his assessment that you're trying to paint Medinsky as being anti-patriotic?
About Medinsky, all that can be said, and Dr. and I agree that the record shows, Medinsky is a little Sir Echo. He has had nothing else for a career except doing exactly what others have told him to do. Not an original thought in that man's career has led him to any public position. In fact, as the record also shows, both of us admitted, he's been charged with serious plagiarism offenses in relation to a PhD he wrote. Not just plagiarism, but what some of distinguished Russian historians have called absurd historical mistakes in his work. The man has been lifted by the president from culture minister to special envoy responsible for negotiations with the Ukraine. And that position has continued to be at that level, according to the presidential spokesman Peskov, as recently as July and August. And Medinsky's status as the principal private negotiator on the Ukraine file was evinced when he participated at high rank in the meetings President Putin had with Hungarian Prime Minister Orban in July, which preceded Orban's visit to Trump and the discussion of terms that the Russians and Trump might consider implementing if Trump wins. That was back in July. And then the prompt for the article that you refer to is Medinsky's sudden appearance and briefing of the Security Council last month, where there was a discussion of the Ukraine, camouflaged by what President Putin referred to as a discussion of history. Russian history. Medinsky is a cipher. He's a stooge. He's a puppet. He's a mouthpiece. There's nothing wrong with being the mouthpiece of a very powerful politician, but that's what he is, and we shouldn't exaggerate what mouthpieces can say or do independently of their boss. Medinsky is there to do what his boss bids him to do. That's fundamental. The man does not have an independent view, whether you call it Russian nationalism or whether you call it anything, patriotism, anything else is irrelevant. The people he holds hands with, for example, Duma member Slutsky, those people have no importance and should be ignored, because Medinsky took his running orders in Istanbul from the president, no one else. And the president also had Roman Abramovich sitting just behind the table, monitoring proceedings and discussing the terms with all of the significant players, including the Turkish President Erdogan at the time. So let's not exaggerate, and that was my intention, let's not exaggerate Vladimir Medinsky. The title of the piece is Sending a Boy to Do a Man's Job. The man's a boy. He's a mouthpiece for the president. So we go back to the issue at stake here, in which Doctorow wants to say that Medinsky / Putin would never contemplate a settlement of the Ukraine war in its present state that violates Russia's national interests. Okay, if that's the case, if that's a proposition, let's look at what the national interests are and what the terms are that Putin, Orban, and Trump have been talking about. We aren't privy to what they actually say, but we've got a number of bits of evidence of what they are likely to be saying. Why? Because Trump keeps repeating. Trump is not an intelligent man. He keeps repeating the same points that he's been given in scripts by his own advisors. And one of the crucial things that Trump could do the day after he's elected, as he's promised, is to cancel some sanctions over some Russians. And that point is one of the promises, partial relief of sanctions in a plan devised by Trump's advisors and published last April. And Trump keeps repeating that line, not so exactly, not so precisely, ever since in his public speeches. Now, relief of sanctions is what the oligarchs want. It's not likely, but it is an executive power of the president, which once the new president is elected in January, can be implemented by the stroke of a pen. That's how it would be done. The hope of the Russian oligarchy and the chairman of the central bank, Nabiullina, and others around Putin is that they can do a military deal on the Ukraine, which will recover their fortunes, their assets, and their access to wealth abroad. That's their hope. They don't make any bones about that. It's obvious. It's Trump's policy, according to the evidence we see. And when you look at Istanbul 1, what you see in the treaty is not only international recognition of Ukraine as a permanently neutral country, not only demilitarization, not only denazification, these are the objectives of special military operation, but one finds at Article 5 of the draft Istanbul 1 treaty, that there would be cancelling of sanctions imposed on Russia since 2014. This is very important to understand. Is the US dedicated, and the European alliance, NATO, dedicated to the destruction of Russia, going to contemplate a deal to save the Ukraine that would end their war against Russia? The military and strategic assessment in Moscow is no, that will not happen without the significant security protections of a capitulation of the Ukraine and its security on Russian military terms. This is what the argument must be about. On the other hand, the argument in Moscow is the oligarchs want relief for themselves. Now, the oligarchs as a group, whether in shipping, in any sector you can think of, coal, oil, gas, nickel, gold, we could go on and on about those areas of international commodity production, mineral production, metal production, aluminium production, in which the oligarchs continue to dominate. In every one of those sectors, the oligarchs have a record, and the presidency has a record of allowing massive capital outflow and export to the west of the world and disinvestment in Russia to the disadvantage of Russian national interests. So when you want to argue about Russian national interests, you better look at the behavior of the oligarchs as investors. They have continually, from beginning to end, not only evaded tax in Russia, but avoided investment in their own country to the benefit of themselves and foreign states. The oligarchs operate their economic model to the disadvantage of the Russian national interest as defined by many people, many parties, and a new consensus arising since the war. So that's a big mouthful. I'll try and sum it up again. The national interest of Russia is properly argued between oligarch interests, state interests, military interests, and small business interests and public interests. And the public's very clear. Russian opinion polls I've reported for years are very clear. The Russian people support the army over the presidency to protect the Russian national interest. The Russian people think the oligarchs do not represent the Russian national interest. Isn't that enough? Isn't that common sense?
Not quite yet, but let's get to Putin. Before that, though, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He serves as principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. And he's been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and advised governments politically at the highest levels over his very long and varied career. We're speaking today about and around his recent article at Dances with Bears, Sending a Boy to Do a Man's Job, Vladimir Medinsky to Negotiate Istanbul 2. I will do a hard break for Ray McGinnis on my second segment. We'll talk about his book, Unjustified, The Freedom Convoy, The Emergencies Act, and the inquiry that got it wrong. You can hear both this long form with John and the divided with Ray McGinnis at my site, gradio.substack.com. That's gradio.substack.com. The venerable guerrilla-radio.com website is soon to be no more, and all of my stuff is going to be placed up at Substack in the very near future. John, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks a lot. We can find John, of course, at Dances with Bears, johnhelmer.net. Thanks again, John.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, 2.5 years on, the trauma created by the Canadian government response to the COVID-19 outbreak is yet to be adequately addressed. The shock suffered the system due to that reaction, it can be argued, was more devastating than the pandemic itself. And few in the government responsible seem anxious to either acknowledge mistakes made or provide remedies for the dangerous legal precedents it created. Ray McGinnis is an author and retired educator who, concerned about the unprecedented invocation of the emergency Emergencies Act in 2022, attended and began reporting on the Public Order Emergency Commission hearings. And he was one of the only journalists in Canada to follow the subsequent Coutts 4 case, publishing numerous articles on its traducing of Canadian legal norms. Ray's book titles include Writing the Sacred, A Psalm-Inspired Path to Appreciating and Writing Sacred Poetry, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked, and the 9/11 Commission Ignored, and the newly released